Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hello and welcome to My Perfect Console. I'm Simon Parkin, and in each episode I invite a guest to pick the five video games they would like to immortalise on their very own fictional games machine. Perhaps it was the first game they received as a birthday present, or the one that so obsessed them it caused them to fail their exams, or maybe it was the only thing that got them through a difficult breakup. Games, a bit like songs, often become powerfully attached to a particular moment in our lives. When we return to them, they can become warp points to the past. So join me, Simon Parkin, for My Perfect Console. My guest today is Editor-in-Chief of Time Out London. After graduating from SOAS University with a degree in religion and the history of art, he moved to China for a few years, then struck out as a freelance writer, contributing to, among other publications, The Times, The Observer, Heat Magazine, and The New Statesman. In 2012, he assumed the role of features editor at the men's magazine FHM, of which he later became deputy editor. And from there, he edited the pioneering newsletter Mr. Hyde, and then became editor of the gravely missed Shortlist magazine. In 2019, he took the top job at Time Out. Throughout his career, my guest has often run video game-themed special editions, building on his personal passion for the medium. Welcome, Joseph McAtish.
Thank you very much, Simon. Very nice to be here.
It's good to have you. I've just been admiring your backdrop. You're in Covent Garden, you told me.
Yeah. We're back in the centre of town after ages of exile. I absolutely love it in the centre of London as well. Like, when I started my career, was lucky enough to work just on Shaftesbury Avenue, and there's obviously so much to do. And now to be able to come back at this point, feels like a bit of a
It's amazing. Now, I'm sure your day to day is pretty varied, but can you give us what's a typical day like for the editor of Time Out London?
Oh, I mean, for Time Out, it really depends on sort of the particular bit of the year you're in. Like, we're recording this just before the coronation, so everything we're doing is sort of coronation related, and that sort of varies from things that are very meat and potatoes, but kind of necessary, such as events that are going on across London, that, you know, food, that's sort of king related food that's happening, but also slightly kind of sideways things as well, which are always fun. We invited in sort of four alternative kings: a drag king, a pearly king, the lead from The Lion King, and an Elvis impersonator, and we did a series of portraits of them with them reflecting on what the coronation means for them. And there's also sort of, you know, essays about, you know, whether people in London really care about it and things like that. So while the coronation's happening, my life is very, very sort of coronation shaped. And then the rest of the time, it sort of just adapts to, you know, whatever else is occurring in London.
And in the sort of earlier years of my career, I would sometimes go on, press junkets, I suppose, maybe to E3 or whatever. And there would often be like a representative from FHM or Stuff or one of those other mags. And, you'd hear their stories, which... It seemed like quite a good life to have, to be working on one of those mags. All sorts of fun trips and exciting things. Was that your experience?
No, not at all. Not at all. Unfortunately, Simon, I came in really at the arse end of everything. And I've been fortunate enough to sort of work with really, really great people. But a friend of mine likened it to being the sort of last person to arrive at a house party at 4 a.m. and everyone's drunk, everything, and everyone's unconscious, and you're just politely going around asking if you can finish the ends of people's drinks because they've had all the fun, and they basically want you to mop up the sick that they've created over the course of their lives. Having said that, I have had a great time doing it, but it became a lot harder. I think when you look back at the sort of early magazines that were lifestyle magazines,
yeah,
they kind of had it easy because there was no competition for time and attention. People had nothing to do apart from spend £4 on a magazine. And when you look at what they produced, they didn't have to work that hard. I think the moment that Facebook and YouTube essentially started monopolizing people's attention for free, it was on us to sort of kick things up a notch. And I do think that video games have had a large part to play in the way I've always approached magazines. And it wasn't so much, oh, let's do an article about video games.
Right.
It was much more to do with incorporating it into larger themes, because our generation are people that think of video game characters and video game narratives in the same way as you would a famous book or a film. So if we were doing a shortlist, let's say, and we did do a massive feature about the concept of a nemesis, why
right.
people deserve a nemesis in life, you would find a way when you've broken it down to incorporate three classic video game nemesis.
Right.
Or a good one I remember as well was interviewing a judge from Crufts for a spread feature called Who's a Fictional Good Boy Then? And it was a professional man assessing fictional dogs. And of course, one of those dogs was from Duck Hunt. It was quote unquote dog from Duck Hunt. And there really are so many examples like that. We had someone rebranding evil corporations with like better logos and stuff. And one of them was Umbrella from Resident Evil. He did a great job with that. So all of my favorite feature ideas, these very large sort of multi-tentacled things, and video games always played a part in them. And I feel like that's a much more honest way to approach the medium for fans than going, here are the top five games that are out this month. So no one needs that. Everyone has
right.
search facilities.
Yeah. I mean, it hasn't stopped many websites from doing that kind of piece. But yeah, I mean, you just describing those pieces immediately makes me want to go and read them and look at what you did and look at what the logo was like for Umbrella and all that stuff. So exciting. Yeah, wonderful.
Yeah, one of your previous guests as well from Churches, we had him in the mag. I remember that was shortlist as well, but he was ranking his most compelling video game monsters, I remember, but in terms of how affecting he found them. And that, remember, that involved Pyramid Head, certainly was in there.
Yeah.
Maybe Blanka and the Kako Demon from Doom. And you create these like wonderful illustrations featuring them all together. And in fact, Simon, I'm probably the only person to go on this great podcast who can claim to have employed you as well.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
Over time. As a freelancer.
Yeah, yeah.
Because we've written about video games so much. And I don't know if your listeners know this, but you are held in an incredibly high regard in the world of writing. Your body of work really speaks for itself. The places that you write for, aren't necessarily normally places that touch on video games. And you always find a way to make them really interesting, very, very novel approach, very, very, serious, but also entertaining. And I've been lucky enough in my career to be able to commission you, from time to time. And it's always been an absolute pleasure.
Oh, what a nice thing to say. I wasn't expecting that. Thank you so much. What do you think, like those ideas that you were discussing there? I mean, they're so creative, and I think they do come from that magazine tradition where you're trying to think of what's an interesting way into this subject that's going to grab people aside from just like the, there's a new film coming out, let's speak to the director or something. It's trying to find perhaps where you don't have access or something, it forces you to take a more creative approach. Is that true? Like, how do you go about coming up with some of those angles?
Well, I'll part the kimono for you now. a little bit of insight. It always, so basically, it always starts with like, what's a big, interesting idea? And actually, we did do a few issues that were purely video game related. So, but it was never just video games. One of them was, do or can video games make you happy? So you'd start there in a brainstorm meeting with all these people who are very creative, very interesting people. I've been so lucky to work with a couple of genuine geniuses, but also loads of just really colorful individuals that had a lot to say. And you'd be in a brainstorm meeting and you would just go through sort of like general big ideas, you know, so it could be the idea of like, you know, beauty in, you know, what is a beautiful video game? What does that mean? Hey, what about video game, you know, weapons and things like that? Like, you know, things along those lines. And then the next stage after that is to work out how these things physically fill a space. And that's where I think experience comes into it, because then you're thinking about, is this illustration? Is it photography? Is it written through? Is it captions? You know, you're working with a designer to create something that's visually very, very pleasant. I think that video games and, you know, can they make us happy thing is a great example, because, well, firstly, that one had you in it and you'd written a great piece about, it was essentially advertising in video games. It was a single page, but that's an example of like a very smart written through essay, doesn't need huge amounts of visuals. And then on the page after that, we'd had this illustrated page, which was like a weapons rack of the most satisfying game weapons that have ever existed. So you had everything from Cloud's Buster Sword next to the blue shell from Mario Kart. What else was it? Belmont's Whip and things like that. But they're all drawn in the same style, all together. And that's just a very, you know, satisfying thing to look at. And there was, you know, writers and novelists talking about the games that they played to get their ideas going. So I suppose you'd always carve up big idea cake into different sized slices that fit into different bits of a magazine. You know, like, does it need to be visual? Does it need to be clever? Does it need to be funny? And you just sort of tick all these boxes until you have something cohesive and consistent and satisfying, which is very hard to do on the internet because you cannot force someone to consume something in a specific order. More's the pity.
Yeah. Cool. What a wonderful sort of advert there for the craft of magazines you've just given us. Wonderful. All right, Joe. So the premise of the podcast is I've asked you to choose the five video games you want to put on your perfect fictional console. Can you tell us about your first choice, which comes from 1989? What is the game and why do you love it?
I think love's a bit of it's a misleading term, but it's the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles game that came out on the Nintendo Entertainment System. The NES, as people in my generation called it. I think the reason I chose this isn't because it's objectively good in any way. It's in fact kind of quite horrible to look at. And difficult's not even the word. It's of that era, I suppose, where games were quite short, and the only way to provide value for money was to make them impossibly hard. Like, so hard that just thinking back on it fills me with a sense of sort of like dread and sort of nausea. I'm pretty sure YouTube is full of sort of man boys screaming about this and how difficult it is, but there was a particular level under a dam, and it's sadistic. It's just absolute sadism. But I suppose the reason I chose it is because it's the first really strong memory I have of finding myself going back again and again and again to something really, really challenging and not really understanding why. Because even though, like, every kid in that era, I mean, I don't know how old you are, but certainly for me, like, liking turtles was a prerequisite for just being a human being.
Right, right.
There was that sort of military-industrial sort of complex thing of cartoon, toy line, video game. And they all had all these things, and that was the king of them. And, you know, tons of rip-offs afterwards, like Bucky O'Hare and Biker Mice from Mars, Battletoads, things like that. Turtles was the first one, and I loved it. But for some reason, this game didn't really have much turtles in it. I can only assume it was, like, I'm fairly sure it didn't have the turtles music anywhere in it. It obviously had the four main characters, but then the monsters all looked like something out of Hellraiser. I don't know where they were from.
Just off-the-shelf monsters or something.
Yeah, absolutely. It's got to have been some, you know, some company that just sort of like had these things ready to go. There were no of the other famous characters in it. And so there was nothing really pulling me in, apart from the fact it was really hard. And I sort of grew to, like, I guess that was like an early addiction, like wanting to complete this game. But I mean, it must have been just the first two or three levels over and over and over again.
Yeah.
Locked into some sort of like Buddhist cycle of sort of death and rebirth over and over again.
So it's a scrolling beat 'em up, isn't it? Sort of in the style of Double Dragon and all that. Could you play as each of the turtles in the NES one? I know you could in the later one, yeah.
Yeah, you absolutely could. But they, as was the way, no one had put that much effort into sort of like balancing it, I think, or programming it. So two of the turtles were fundamentally useless because their weapons were tiny. And then two of them were sort of okay. It wasn't as I can't sort of overemphasize how not fun the game was and like how sort of unpleasant it was. And it sort of burnt itself into my subconscious in a way that I suspect means it turns up in loads of like dreams I have now. You know, when something was kind of quite sort of madly sort of traumatic and repetitive. I'm fairly sure it's sort of that the reservoir level pops up as a sort of stress dream I have over and over again. And there were far, far better games. For, you know, there's like sort of ones that I was thinking about picking for this. Like I used to love a game called Faxanadu for the NES, which was, it had a very sort of grim atmosphere. And it was, you know, a very early sort of RPG, very medieval. So could have gone for that. There was another one called Snake Rattle and Roll, which was incredibly colorful and really well made, like loads of those early NES games was. But I sort of couldn't overlook Turtles for what it represented in terms of pop culture. I also think, without wanting to sort of claim anything too sort of significant, the look of that early 90s stuff, whether it's you know, toy packaging, front cover of a comic, it definitely had a huge impact on the way that I've approached sort of graphic design and magazine covers throughout my whole career. You know, the stuff that made those things so appealing to us as young kids was this mad over the top aesthetic. So more is more, you know, massive, you know, sort of a block shadow on letters. The packaging just has to like stand out from Woolworths or whatever. And when I looked back on sort of magazines and stuff from before our generation, everything's much more sophisticated and calmer. I feel like it required influence from Japan to show that, like, no, you can go all out with graphic design, have a huge amount of fun, and it will still look grown up if you do it right. You know, like, if it's not a mess. And I think those things like Thundercats and Turtles, when I was a kid, was the first instances of a really over-the-top, sort of massive, colorful aesthetic sort of had an impact on me.
Yeah, amazing. So the NES, was that your first console in your household?
Yeah, we were like a Nintendo household up until the Dreamcast, which I'll get onto.
Right.
I don't know why. I feel like as a kid, you are forced to have sort of irrationally strong sort of attachment to like one or the other company.
Yeah.
You look back on it now and no idea why for some reason we were Nintendo. It could have easily been, you know, Sega.
Yeah.
But if you'd asked me then, I would have I would not have spent my time with any Sega people, let me tell you. I was Nintendo through and through, which was newly. But yeah, loved the NES. A great looking object as well. This sort of quite kind of hostile grey box.
Yeah,
they only started making consoles look friendly and rounded, I think, from the generation after this. But the NES, it looks almost quite like an alien sort of object.
It's almost Soviet, isn't it? Like the grey box,
very utilitarian.
Yes,
yeah. I think we should bring that back to sort of gaming with consoles now, because everything's either an enormous sort of monolith statement piece thing, or it's a sort of incredibly friendly, rounded thing.
Yeah.
I'd like to see the reintroduction of objectively ugly grey boxes.
So tell me, whereabouts did you grow up then?
Oh, a part of London that isn't really famous for anything, Paddington.
Oh, right, okay. Quite central then.
Yeah, it's quite central and stuff. It's changed a lot now. It was close, of course, to the Queensway Ice Bowl. So you could walk there in about 20, 25 minutes. There was a massive shopping centre called Whiteley's, which had, you know, Tower Records and things like that. But also a bit further down, Queensway, there was the Ice Bowl.
Yeah, Ice Rink.
Arcade in it, like tons and tons of arcades. So that might have been my earliest memory of an arcade. Because when I was young, arcades were still quite vital. You know, people went
to
video game arcades. It was exciting.
Yeah.
I think it was between that whatever the one in the Trocadero was called at that time. I do, by the way, if you're interested in the Trocadero, which obviously you are because everyone is, There was a great feature written for Time Out last year just about the history.
Oh, lovely.
And it incorporates absolutely everything. You can say this, the weird Sega World thing, the weirdness of that, and, you know, driven by Alien Wars that was downstairs.
Yeah.
That incredible, it was a sort of proto immersive theater experience that was there. Yeah, I've always loved the Trocadero, but I can't remember if the Queensway Ice Bowl or the Trocadero was my first experience. I do remember them both being quite sort of formative for me.
Yeah, me too, yeah. Maybe we were there at the same time as kids, because I used to come up with my friends to Trocadero and what have you. And was the ice rink at Queensway that you're discussing? Yeah.
Yeah, that was that one. The Connoisseur's Choice, eventually, was a place, obviously, that I used to play truant from school quite regularly and go to the Namco arcade in Piccadilly. Not the one that was...
Oh, not the one on the river?
No.
Okay.
There was one in Piccadilly. The only evidence for its existence, as far as I can tell, is a clip on YouTube of a sort of a BBC crime series, and one scene is shot in that arcade because the killer is like some kind of sort of strange incel arcade lunatic. And the police follow him down, and he's playing, I'm assuming, Time Crisis or something like that. So they can get the close up shot of the guy glasses with the reflection of the gunfire in them to show he's a psycho. Yeah, I think that's on there on YouTube. But I love that place. There was absolutely no compromises to creating some sort of family friendly ice rink sideshow. It was an arcade for men, as far as I could tell. It was quite dark and it smelt bad.
Right.
But it had a lot of kind of fighting games.
Like, yeah, yeah.
Japanese, like two-dimensional fighting games, which I'm actually very weirdly interested in, which I think we could get onto that later. But the rate at which they have to churn out characters that stick, you know, that to me has always been fascinating. Just sketching and sketching and sketching. What about this person that's got a bow tie and dancing shoes? No, okay. What about this person? And they wear a top hat and they're topless. No, okay. You know,
keep going
until something sticks. You go like, a sumo wrestler with face paint on? Yeah, okay, yeah, that one works. That one, eat Honda, let's go. It seems so arbitrary what works and what doesn't. And I've always been vaguely jealous of the people, you know, for whom their job is just churning out sort of prototypes for characters, like beat-em-up characters specifically.
Yeah, very interesting. Mate, you're talking about the Namco station I never went to the one you were describing, but I went to the one on the River Thames quite a few times before it closed down. And I remember playing air hockey there and the puck flying off, and it was all like mirrored glass everywhere, and it smashing one of the mirrors. So.
Yeah, that's your shame.
Yeah, that is.
I feel like you would find it in particular quite a hard thing to live with.
Yes.
Like smashed mirrors. When was that? Has your
a long time ago. Yeah, hasn't come up in therapy, but
no. But you're a lost period of bad luck.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if you smash multiple mirrors, in which case you're probably serving consecutive bad luck life sentences.
Oh dear. Right. Well, good time then to come to your second game, I think, which is a fighting game. So yeah, tell us about this one.
Next up is Mortal Kombat 2, which I think was 1992 or 1993. This was seismic, I feel, for people of my generation. I think people always point to the launch of the PlayStation, which was sort of 1996 or 7, as when sort of gaming suddenly seemed like it was aimed at people who were a bit older. There was that, you know, the incredible ad with the girl with a bulbous head, and she's talking about sort of, why would I want to land on the moon? I've never been to Grimsby, which is something that you can... I rewatched it just the other day, actually, in preparation for this. And it's an incredible bit of advertising because it really does have a message. People watched it at the time and just went, oh, that's very peculiar and outlandish. But actually, it does relate to video games, does relate to consoles, and it does it without ever showing a video game or a console.
Yes.
Absolutely fantastic. And I feel like it was Cunningham, wasn't it, who did the Aphex Twin videos?
Yeah, that's certainly the style of it, yeah, even if he wasn't the director, but yeah.
In any case, people, or sheeple, if you like, point towards that and also Wipeout as the moment that suddenly video games became cool. You know, Wipeout, dance music in it and things like that. But actually, to me, Mortal Kombat 2, which I, in my mind, I've sort of dovetailed with the release of Reservoir Dogs,
right,
which is like the beginning of sort of blockbuster meta postmodern cinema. Those two things together to me seemed almost they went hand in hand in people's lives, things moving forwards, like American filmmaking moving forwards, video games suddenly being darker and more bloody. Mortal Kombat, of course, very funny for all the, very sort of famous. Mortal Kombat famous for all the gore. In retrospect, it's ridiculous. It's all massive globs of ketchup flying all over the place. I feel like the first one, which didn't obviously make as big an impact as the second one, is grimmer. I think the sort of the slightly VHS quality of the sort of mocap makes it feel a bit like some sort of, you know, sort of forbidden video.
Like a video nasty.
It does have the vibe of a video nasty. And also, I think the fatalities in that one were also just because of the limits of technology, they were sort of grimmer. So later on, it was like, oh, what if Liu Kang turns into a dragon and bites your man in half? Whereas in the first one, it was like, he'll just rip his heart out. That's it. Like, the guy falls to the ground and Kano's holding a heart. The best one, of course, as everyone would remember, was Sub-Zero ripping the head off with the spine. That's important. But the second one came about, and I feel like it had much better frame rate. The sprites were way bigger. The colors were darker. And it was just mind-blowing. Something about it seemed so immersive and substantial, even though it was bollocks. You know, it was dreamt up by a load of guys that loved old kung fu films and martial arts and things. They probably had a great time doing it. I think I remember reading at the time, the whole thing from conception to being finished was made in like 10 months, something insane like that. Like,
really? Gosh.
Take them long. I think that was the second one, might be the first one. The game magazines went mad for it. I remember competitions where people would, you know, design a new Mortal Kombat character, and then you'd win a Mortal Kombat 2 arcade machine if you had the best one. And then I remember one, this is quite a weird detail to remember, but I remember it was such a hot commodity. There was a magazine that put a trailer or a teaser, a preview about Mortal Kombat 2 or 3 on the cover, but they didn't have any imagery that related to it. But that didn't stop them from doing a Mortal Kombat 3 cover that I think was just like a sort of stick drawing of someone's head falling off or something like that. And I mean, they must have just thought, put this thing on the cover. It's a license to print money.
Right.
And I believe it was. It was probably responsible for people flying back to arcades as well.
Yeah.
People just desperate to show off that they knew the fatalities and the babalities and the friendships and things like that.
I
do have one very early memory of seeing Mortal Kombat 2 is quite bizarre, because my younger brother, who I love dearly, he was at school very, very, very young with Louis Amos, who is the son of Martin Amos, the very famous novelist, himself the son of Kingsley Amos. And I must have been nine, no older than that. And for some reason, Martin Amos had come to pick up my brother and Louis for a day out, and I just went with them. And because I was a little bit older, I was like 2 years older than them.
Right.
I was sat in the front of the car, unaware of who Martin Amos was, but also aware that sort of my parents were quite impressed by him. So he must be important and clever. And I remember just trying to make some adult conversation with this like impossibly famous writer. And he took us to the Queensway Ice Bar.
No way.
He was interested in Mortal Kombat 2. Mortal Kombat 2 had interested Martin Amos in some way.
Well, he loves arcades, doesn't he? He did a book on arcades in the 80s.
Yes, Simon, he did. And he's tried very hard to get that out of circulation. And he's failed to do so. If you have any way of tracking this book down, I think it was republished recently, do get it. Because it's a proper, it's a real sort of curate's egg. If that's the right phrase. I'm not sure. I should know. I'm an editor. It's a bizarre book.
Yeah, he does like tips and cheats, doesn't he, on how to beat Donkey Kong or whatever.
Yeah, but that's interspersed with sort of like sprawling 8,000 word essays on like what Caravaggio could have learned from, you know, Space Invaders. Like, I don't remember.
Yeah.
A really, really bizarre mishmash. It doesn't feel like it was an easy birth.
Right. Wait, did you play Mortal Kombat with Martin Amos then?
No, there but for the grace of God. I mean, really, really close. We stood next to each other. Well, you know, Louis and my brother went off to involve themselves with childish things. And Martin and myself, meanwhile, just stood there considering the Mortal Kombat 2 machine for a while, you know, sort of working out what it meant for society, that sort of a thing. And I remember, just sort of watching people go up and sort of play it, and him being sort of interested in this, in the hold that it appeared to have on young people.
Right.
And it definitely did. It really, really did. I mean, I remember there were like people who used to hang around arcades waiting to essentially jump in for you and be like, oh, do you want me to do this character's fatality for you? Because they were just addicted to doing fatalities, which sounds sort of mad. But they were there. I remember the fatality junkies.
What an incredible story. Maybe that must have been the time he was writing London Fields around then. So, which is,
I'd like to think that I had an influence. Yes, I had an influence on him. That the time that he spent with me in the arcade, watching people, you know, fail to do Sub-Zero's spine rip fatality.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Finish him. So tell me, you moved to China, and then what was that? Why did you go there?
I don't know.
Okay.
In retrospect, I'm not sure. I feel like I didn't really know what I wanted to do for a living.
Yeah.
And you know, I only really fell into this accidentally because I studied the study of religion and history of art. And the history of art that I found most interesting was always Chinese art, modern Chinese art, and also sort of stuff from the Cultural Revolution and this period. And so I just sort of moved there and was there for quite a while. I lived in Shanghai for ages, and then also a city which is small by their standards called Yangzhou. It's got, you know, 4 million people living in it, so it's not small by our standards.
Right.
And I got a job in a university. I stayed with a family, learned the language, and had an absolutely brilliant time. And I feel like having had the experience of just sort of striking out and going and living somewhere, it does take the sting out of life a little bit. Because you always think, well, if everything does go, you know, completely wrong, go pear-shaped, there's always China. I can always run away to the other side of the world to some flat, because I've done it before and it worked out really, really well. I mean,
were you teaching English?
Yeah, it was conversational English, and it was
right
in a series of places, but like the class sizes differed. It was just me, and they differed from sort of some classes that would be sort of 15 students to another class that was about 100 students. And the disparity in terms of, you know, who was good and who was bad was absolutely enormous.
Right.
They were all doing different things at this college. Like, some of them were studying to be pharmacologists, and some of them were studying to be gardeners.
Right.
The gardeners didn't really care about learning English. I don't think it would have really come in that much use.
Sure.
But I made some good friends. And also for them, you know, Premier League football and video games were huge. But I suppose not really video games, because no one had a console.
Mm.
What they did have was like local access local area networks.
LANs, yeah.
Whatever you just said, that one. They would go to these very smoky cafes and spend ages and ages playing games that looked, to me, it looked very, very sort of prehistoric and not fun at all.
Right.
But for them, they would put like 15 hours into these things at a time. And the government at the time was also pretty heavily involved in sort of creating propaganda to suggest these games were bad for the fabric of society.
Right.
And bad for the human condition. So you'd read these stories in the local newspapers, and you'd see things on the news about how someone had like lost a sword in a massive online role-playing game, and then sort of quietly put their mouse down and traveled all the way across China to track down and kill in real life the person who had stolen their sword.
Right.
Which is probably nonsense. There was another one about two kids that stayed up all night playing EverQuest or Ultimate Online or one of the great many Chinese knockoffs. And they were so tired on their way home that they lay down on a railway. And were killed by an oncoming train. Again, like, there was something about the way it was reported that really seemed fictional.
Right.
About 15 years ago. But they all loved these places. And they did have a real atmosphere to them because of all the smoking. And drinking. These huge sort of like subterranean rooms. That reminded me of the first internet cafes and sort of game bars that existed in London long time ago. They were sort of outlaw places. They felt a bit like they operated on the edges of legality, and they weren't pleasant. They weren't sort of like made attractive for outsiders at all. I always found that very, very enigmatic and interesting. There's one, I think it's still there. The only one that I really feel has that vibe still is on the Caledonian Road. And I've only been there once, but I used to live right next to it, and it's called Meltdown.
Right.
And unlike a lot of these new places that have opened up that are very shiny and very photogenic and heavily branded, Meltdown was, you know, for the lizard brain. It was for the goblin mode within us, and it really catered to that. But I really like that honesty, and I like that you know, people who want that have somewhere to go, which is sociable, and they can sort of like have a good time and be around people that like it. And it's you haven't got the sort of the hand of branding coming to
right.
Interview to make it sort of palatable.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not always necessary.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, Joe, we may come to your third game, but. You know, this is kind of relevant because it's a game in which you can visit sort of cafes and things like that in it, and I guess has that sense of being in a foreign country. So tell us about this one from the year 2000.
The next game on my list is inevitably Shenmue. I never replayed Shenmue, so all of my memories are probably, you know, rose-tinted to the degree that I couldn't be considered an objective source. But I think what's fascinating about it is it's almost like the purest example of an enormous company doing something so incredibly stupid, but for the right reason. You know, this was the last roll of the dice for the Dreamcast console, which was in itself the last roll of the dice for Sega as a hardware manufacturer, as far as I know. And the idea, they were like, look, what's going to save this company? What's a real surefire game that, you know, is, it can't fail because it's just, you know, it's going to be easy to make, but, you know, it's like a low risk thing. And someone, presumably Yu Suzuki, said, well, how about the most expensive game that's ever made, which basically involves you wandering quietly around a Japanese suburban town, tracking down sailors and playing even older retro arcade games. Like this is going to be the one. It's just so charming. It's just so charming. And people think of it as an open world game, but it wasn't at all. It was a sort of boring life simulator
with a vague murder mystery going on sort of in the background.
Yeah, yeah. But then even then, you know, compared to games nowadays, there was no obvious handholding.
Yeah.
You know, it didn't say you'd speak to someone in the street and they'd say, oh, if you want to find out about the sailors, you have to go and speak to May. But there would be no arrow that told you where May was or who May was or what time of the day May would come out of their house, because I think the most wonderful thing about Shenmue and the thing that influenced me was that they'd created little lives for these. It was like 250 unique little people who lived in that town. And I'm sure a lot of those unique lives consisted of leaving the house at 7 a.m, fishing until 8 p.m, and then going back home.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of them, they would go to the shop, they would go to work, they would go to the high street, and it was magical. Like the idea that this place would be doing all this stuff, whether or not you were there. And the fact, I think that the weather system was based on an actual town's weather system from
yes.
the 8th.
Yes,
which is,
that's
which
right.
Is, that's a beautiful concept. It really, really is. It's quite moving.
Yeah.
And then they just put in all these sort of bizarre mini games, like the docks one. My friend, actually, his version of Shenmue was broken and he didn't realize it. But once the docks game started, if you don't know what I'm talking about, there was a mini game where you drove a forklift all day. And I feel like that was maybe that was like a very clever meta comment, because you'd have the clock in the corner that would show you when you can stop being on the forklift, and you would just sit there lifting and dropping boxes, looking at the clock, waiting for it to get to 5 p.m.
Yeah.
And then you realize that you were doing this in your spare time, essentially. That was a sort of cruel trick being played on us by Mr. Suzuki. My friend's copy of Shenmue stopped at that point. It didn't let you ever get past the forklift. So he was doing that for weeks and weeks. Like, I think he entered into a sort of strange fugue state eventually. Like, I said, it was a waking dream state where he just accepted it as his future.
Yeah.
But I absolutely loved it. And also, the other thing about Shenmue was that unless my memory is playing tricks on me, there's very little fighting in it.
No,
I feel like all of the advertising back in the day made it look like an action game, like a sort of, you know, scrolling beat 'em up. But actually, you very, very rarely had to fight. And I feel like that sort of made the combat feel more significant in a way. It's like when you're actually called to, you know, for your sort of wonderfully thick protagonist, when he had to fight, it felt kind of special. He was great. I can't remember his name, but
Ryu. I can't remember, yeah.
It might have been Ryu. Yeah, I felt like he was a Ryu or a Ryo.
Yeah.
But he was just this incredibly credulous kind of like nice guy who walked around in this sort of, he was wearing a sort of leather jacket.
Yeah, white t-shirt.
Yeah. Yeah, that was it. Yeah, yeah. What an iconic look. And then, of course, the sad thing was he created this incredible game. Well, I think it was incredible. And it just was not, you know, mainstream at all.
No.
It was bizarre, actually, in retrospect. And then I can't remember how long afterwards, but, you know, Grand Theft Auto would have come out, and just people were like, oh, no, that's what a free game feels like.
Yeah.
When you blow things up.
I think it was like 3 years later. But it was, you know, Shenmue was so influential, even though, as you say, it wasn't particularly mainstream, because it was the first sort of 3D world. You could wander around, the shops opened at particular times according to the in-game clock and all that. So it just had all of these, you know, amazing innovations in 3D, at least, that then became commonplace in all the games we play today.
Yeah, I loved as well just the attention to detail with, you know, you go into the little sort of workman's cafe, you know, by the sea, and just looking at, you know, the fact that someone had designed the little soy sauce bowls that were on the tables and things like that. It was, to me, that was almost touching. It felt so beautifully realized and poetic. It just wasn't really a video game in retrospect.
Yeah. So you finish your stint in China and come back to the UK, become a freelancer, and then go on to work as a features editor. I wanted to ask you, I read a little interview with you where you sort of alluded to this anecdote but didn't really explain it. So you mentioned that one time you drank vodka in the penthouse apartment of a Russian billionaire while he sang to you, backed by a full backing band. How did you get in that situation?
Well, I don't want to make all this sound too sort of laddie or anything like that. Like the vodka, it was deeply unpleasant and uncomfortable. I was not having fun, but that was a feature with a guy. I don't know if I should name him, but he was the son of one of the OG oligarchs in Russia, you know, one of the Yeltsin guys who essentially, you know, raised a small family in a tiny flat. And then by the end of his life, and he's still alive now, owns an empire of, you know, a fleet of luxury cars, you know, property.
Owns half of London, probably.
Yes, yeah, quite possibly. But his son was also a property developer, nice enough guy, but had aspirations of being a pop star. So he'd been entered into Russia's Eurovision thing and was representing the country. And we found out about this guy, and it sounded so peculiar. So we went and I just stayed with him for a while in Moscow. And he was like an affable enough dude. But first thing he showed me was like a video of Donald Trump on his phone wishing him happy birthday, like personally. And then another one from Robert De Niro, which is weird.
That is weird.
That's sort of a black mark next to De Niro's name for me after that.
Right. This is before the days of Cameo as well, I guess.
It was. No, yeah, this was literally your man Trump messaging this guy just a little video.
Wow.
And, you know, to rehearse in his family, and his dad had essentially built him his own bespoke arena, which is still there, you know, and it was created to give him a sort of a venue that he could always use.
Oh, my gosh.
But I remember going back to his apartment, which was in the middle of Moscow. And you enter the apartment via an elevator that goes from, you know, the lobby. I opened up into his flat and stepped out into his flat. And there was just this backing band in his living room, which the living room itself is the size of a library. And the backing band it wasn't a small band. It had the backing band had backing singers in it. And they were waiting for him in his apartment, just sort of jamming. You know, so when they sort of like swaying from left to right, just like playing a kind of riff over and over again. I don't know how long they'd been there doing that for. When he came in, he sort of saw them and he took his jacket off and he was like, "Oh, give me a moment, will you?" And just like grabbed the microphone and started singing with them. So I just sort of had nothing to
what?
Do. Yes, yeah, so sort of sit down with my sort of small glass of Russian standard vodka and just sort of nod appreciatively and thought about. I know that one was very emotional. That one was the word I kept using. That one was really emotional.
And he put all this on for your benefit, do you think?
Yes, I think so. I think it was for me. But yeah, that was a pretty mad one. There were a lot of features that you would sign up to and you would come up with because there was an opportunity to like travel a little bit. But it was, in retrospect, fun. Had I known I'd be dining out on these stories so much in the future, I'd have done a lot more of them. But yeah, that one sticks in the mind. There's tons.
Yeah.
I mean, that was the thing. When you look back on sort of journalism at its peak in this country, they stopped doing that stuff for so long because it's such a pain in the ass. They would just, you know, people would often write features just from their desk, whereas everything which is entertaining, usually, unless the person's very funny, but that's very rare. Funny writers are rare, unless they're very funny. To make someone interested in what you're writing, you have to do something. You have to go.
You've got to get out the house.
Exactly. Experience something and describe it in a way which is, you know, a little bit salacious and interesting and exciting. Like, doesn't matter what the publication is. It can be the highest brow newspaper. It can be the lowest brow tabloid. You've got to give a little bit of jeopardy, a little bit of danger, all that stuff that keeps people reading. I think it's very important.
Yeah, yeah. In fact, going back to Amos, I think he says in the foreword of one of his collections of journalism that he did for The Observer in the 90s that, you know, the benefit of signing up to do these things is that it gets you out of the house, and you've got to get out of the house if you want to get material. So, yeah, very true.
Absolutely. The job that I had at the time of that Russian one was FHM, and there were absolutely tons of stories like that. And they're not particularly sort of laddie or sort of, none of them are shameful. They were just quite fun and interesting and taught me a lot about writing and editing as well. But it was a hard, hard job. And actually, the difficulty of that job directly relates to the next game.
Right, okay. Yeah, well, okay, let's use that as the segue then. So tell us about your fourth game.
I feel like this one's not very original, and I'd be very surprised if it hasn't popped up. But this is Mario Kart. Specifically, I would say the Mario Kart 8/8 Deluxe, which is still the most recent one, I think. Do you play Mario Kart, Simon?
I do, yeah, yeah.
Who's your character?
Black Yoshi.
Okay, good. Yeah, exactly the same as my friend Chris, I hope he's listening. The impact that Mario Kart had on me and my colleagues cannot be understated. We had this job that was so hard. It was sort of towards the end of conventional publishing, and we were still putting out this magazine. We were so young. We were like in our sort of mid to early 20s, most of us. And we were not qualified enough to be doing this. And we would just finish each issue. And everything we did was bespoke. Bespoke photography, bespoke illustration. Bespoke, yeah, everything was written really, really sort of with a lot of detail. And we would finish each issue and just sort of collapse. And then immediately start on the next one from scratch, which in retrospect just seems insane. But throughout all of it, we had Mario Kart. And it started off because one of the first issues we did a feature where we forced young people to play very old games, see what they made of them. And I remember a lot of them were just, they were very young kids, and they were sort of weirded out that when you killed people in GoldenEye, it didn't yield resources like in Minecraft. And also, it just made it clear that very old games just aren't really fun. But we kept the N64 in the office. And that one had a copy of Mario Kart, which we played together. And we eventually went through every single iteration of the game until we ended up with 8 Deluxe. And we'd called in, you know, this is not painting a very sympathetic picture of us. We'd managed to call in for the World Cup like a 90-inch television, which we fastened to the wall. And we just had Mario Kart on it. And the job was so much and so stressful that Mario Kart became this blessed relief for everyone.
Right.
I feel like, because I wasn't the editor did let us do it. because I think he knew how important it was as a sort of like pressure relief valve.
Right.
We would just stand up and someone would be like four player and four of you would just walk over and everyone had their set, their characters. And the mad thing is, it's like I've forgotten so much of the amazing work these people have done in their career with me, whether it's there or Mr. Hyde or Shortlist. But I know exactly which character each of them plays. And I know exactly how they play. We got so good at Mario Kart, Simon, that we actually had to eventually play a version of it that we called Pure, where you would turn off you would turn off the computer characters and the weapons.
Nice.
So essentially it became like this very unforgiving sort of Mario Kart F1, where if you made a single mistake on a corner, you were out. It was like there was no point continuing because you knew the other three people were not going to make a mistake.
Right.
So it was just like trying to get the slipstream. It was, in retrospect, like a sort of like horrifying sort of dedication to something completely arbitrary and unedifying. But we all do still talk about it to this day. It brought us all really, really close together. Like the experience of just like having that one thing that was for a while. Like as great as the job was, it made us all go mad. And this thing in the office was the reason that we didn't quite go mad, I think.
Right. Car extraordinary. Were you working super late hours? And so that was helping with the...
Whenever we got to press deadlines, it would always be like super late hours. Because teams were something much smaller.
Yeah.
So you were sort of processing a similar number of pages, but with, you know, half a number of designers or one designer and like, you know, no... You know, the jobs that do take a long time are things like sub-editing, which is sadly an endangered species of a position, but it's incredibly necessary to have someone who's making sure that things are spelled correctly, things are, all the grammar's okay, that there's a house style, and you can't rush that. You know, it just takes a while for someone to read everything and make sure it's not like garbage. And if you reduce the number of subs to one or whatever, it's just going to create a sort of bottleneck. It was like this late night thing, but I think because we were young, it was fun as well because no one had any sort of responsibilities. No one had family or anything like that. So it was just an extension of like being in a pub together because you'd have like beers in the office and things like that. And Mario Kart was just a completely integral part of what we were doing. And I feel like Mario Kart's like popped up a lot in tons and tons of features that we've done over the in the past. Like it's an inescapable part of my life.
Yeah. I mean, we happen to be talking at a time when there are major layoffs happening in the media industry. Of course, that's all of the time. But BuzzFeed News is on the way out. Vice is either bankrupt or close to it, isn't it? But it seems like at the moment it's the web outlets that are suffering. Do you think, you know, talking there about teams on magazines getting smaller and smaller, do you think that assault has sort of leveled out now, at least when it comes to the print side? Or is there worse to come?
You never know. I mean, the thing is, in my career, me and my peers, you know, for a lot of us, all we've ever known is diminishing resource. But what I would say is that I think we've turned a corner with all of that. And certainly at Time Out Now, our bad period came a little while ago, related directly to the pandemic. I can tell you that being the editor of a magazine about going out during a global pandemic, no fun whatsoever.
Right.
Oh my God, it was terrible. But we now, you know, we have people joining all the time and it feels very optimistic. The problem is with you know, I really liked Waypoint, which was the Vice video game vertical. That was a long time ago. Noisy, the music won thump.
Yep.
The dance music, motherboard computers, very, very good. And I have no problem with any of those websites because they were good and they were aimed at a niche number of people and they were written by people that cared about the subject matter.
Yeah.
In the same way Edge magazine would have been for Waypoint people, you know, Mixmag for Thump, yada yada yada. The difference is people paid for Mixmag and people paid for Edge. When it comes to a vertical and a website, it's all well and good having a niche audience unless you've got some sort of mad billionaire who wants a return on investment or a load of shareholders, and they'll look at the number of people who are interested in dance music and just say, why would I care about a number that small? Which is sad, because niche audiences is what makes things interesting. You know, the people who listen to this great podcast, I'm sure, are interested specifically in the subject matter. They want to hear about specific consoles and games and things like that. There are only so many of those people. You know, Kurt Vonnegut said, if you open the window and try and make love to the world, you just catch a cold. And it's true. You cannot appeal to that many people at the same time, which is what big media companies still want. So something like Vice, that was only ever going to appeal to a small number of people, and that was just clearly not enough for the shareholders and the stakeholders. It could have been different if, you know, companies in this country had figured out a way to advertise nicely. But as you know, like most UK, most London websites, they just look horrible. They're just, you know, ugly, experience-destroying adverts plastered all over the place. You know, to paraphrase David Simon, you know, how little respect do you have to have for your product to not only give it away for free, but to also make it look like shit? No wonder people aren't used to paying for this stuff when we just, you know, it's been packaged up in a way that is just nickel and diming it, you know, earning half a penny for a page view. You know, who would have thought if you do a website about dance music specifically, half a penny a page view was not going to cut the mustard. So hopefully we're turning a corner now where people will manage to find a way to monetize niche audiences who don't mind spending a couple of quid for something that speaks directly to them. You know,
right.
They'll, you know, join a Patreon for a podcast if the people who do the podcast seem to actually give a damn about what they love. I feel like conventional media, it'll either have to follow suit or just sort of die on its ass.
Very interesting. Right, let's come to your fifth and your final game, Joe. Tell us about this one.
Yeah, well, this sort of ties into the pandemic a little bit. I got this job at the start of 2020 and had 3 great months of working out how Timeout worked and everything. And then, of course, COVID-19 happened. And we have a couple of years that I've, you know, tried very hard now to suppress. Bad time for a lot of people. I hated it. And for me, this next game was so important in getting through it. And the game was the remastered version of Dark Souls. Dark Souls, like Shenmue, sort of isn't what it was advertised as. And I'd never played it up until that point, up until 2020. And I should say as well, I used, like a lot of people, I found it very hard to read during the pandemic. My attention span was very bad and I wanted to read, I couldn't. But for some reason, I could play games. And I used the Nintendo Switch to sort of go back and finish all these games from my childhood that I'd never actually got to the end of. There was absolutely tons. I remember, I think Super Castlevania and Super Metroid were the ones that I enjoyed the most. And then, you know, Zelda, Link to the Past, Secret of Mana, the first Resident Evil, which I enjoyed a huge amount, many more besides. And then someone said, oh, you should definitely add Dark Souls to that list because it is a classic. And I was like, well, it doesn't look like my sort of thing, but I'll give it a go. And I think the reason that it resonated so much is that, like, it's the only game I can think of that I've played as an adult that elicited actual relief and emotion because the game hates you. Like, the game wants you almost... It's a strange sort of yin-yang thing where the game wants you to fail, but because it wants you to fail, it helps you to succeed. And you can talk about... You know, that's the thing. If someone hasn't played Dark Souls, talking about it in these terms is very alienating for them. But I believe there is like a lot to be said about the thinking that went into it. The fact that it's like relentless failure and there is no arbitrary sort of progress system or hand holding. The only way you can go from A to B to C to D is pure human determination.
Right.
You feel like you've been reduced to something almost like elemental.
Yes.
I think when you're playing it. And what's also novel is that you fear death in a game. Most games, there's not a price to pay for dying, whereas in Dark Souls, there is. And so when you're sort of walking into these incredibly hostile, atmospheric places, and you have no idea where you are, the idea that you could be sort of murdered at any moment carries a sort of a real weight and a real significance. It's not open world at all. In fact, the world is the most wonderful thing about it because it's sort of linear, pretty much linear. And then as you're going through it, you sort of have it revealed to you that the whole thing is just sort of bound together. And you're sort of wondering at one point, oh my God, am I absolutely tiny? Am I the size of an acorn, or am I a giant? The way the world reveals itself to you is so beautiful. And I know that you've interviewed the creator. That's right, isn't it?
Yeah.
How did you find that?
Well, I've interviewed him a couple of times. The first time was for Dark Souls, actually, before the game was out. And he didn't want to give much away, to be honest. So he wanted to... I think he's someone who really prizes that sense of discovery and vagueness. And those are all the things he enjoys in the fantasy that he reads and watches and all of that. So, yeah, you sort of... I was there writing for Edge magazine, actually. And so you're trying to get concrete details for the game, and it was very difficult. But more recently, I interviewed him for The New Yorker, and that was more of a profile. And he was much more comfortable talking about his life and inspirations and all of that sort of thing. So that seems like he's not someone who wants to explain his work anyway.
No, and I feel like The New Yorker is a better, more sort of suitable place for him probably than a video game magazine. I do always remember those stories that Shigeru Miyamoto told about why he wanted to make Zelda, was sort of creating almost like a sort of facsimile of the feelings of childhood exploration.
Yeah.
Finding a cave and going into somewhere unexplored. And I think Dark Souls actually sort of conveys that feeling equally well, if not better. And the whole thing's obviously sort of tinged with horror.
Yep.
But to me, it's that feeling of being completely out of your element. And my friend described it very well, where he said all of those games, you know, Elden Ring included, but Dark Souls especially, they sort of feel like your character has turned up in this world after something very significant happened. You're not really ever sure what that is, but you're sort of late to the party.
Right.
And I love the way that the story just sort of washes over you, and you can be as interested in it as you'd like. I mean, I feel like Bioshock is sort of similar. They're beautiful, though rich way of telling stories. You know, the voice acting in it is so strange. You know, everyone just sort of talks and laughs. Really, really original and memorable.
Yeah, sure is. Wonderful. Okay, Joe, let's go through your console. So we've got here Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, Mortal Kombat 2, Shenmue, Super Mario Kart 8 Deluxe, and Dark Souls Remastered for the Switch. That sounds wonderful. Nice little selection there. How are you feeling about it?
Yeah, I mean, in retrospect, the thing that I'm realizing is a lot of these are just sort of miserable experiences that have most of the fun attached to them.
We do work in magazines.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Addicted to misery and suffering. Yeah. I think the common theme, maybe apart from Mario Kart, is just sort of like wandering through a sort of twilight world of sort of like pain. And sort of like a lot of difficulty as well. And Mortal Kombat, Turtles, even Shenmue is often like overcast and sad. Dark Souls, not painting a particularly sort of optimistic picture of myself here. I'm a nice person.
No, it's great.
I am.
Okay, what should we call your console then?
Well, I was desperately just now trying to rush into English translate Grey Box. You're saying there's some sort of return to Soviet aesthetics. If you could do the honors and just find out how to say Grey Box in Russian, then we have a sort of nice brutalist utilitarian console.
Okay.
That no wife, girlfriend, or husband of a gamer would ever want put up within their homes.
All right, cool. I'll add that to the outro when we get to that bit. All right, just before I let you go, Joe, you spend a lot of time thinking about London, I guess, and experiencing things in it. If I got 2 days in London in 2023, what do I need to go and see?
Oh, God, I hate when people put me on the spot like that. Because it really, really does change all the time. What I would say is quite excited for the Young V&A opening, which used to be the Museum of Childhood and Home.
Yes.
Beth Lord Reed. That's about to reopen this summer. And I think that'll be really, really great. Also this year is the largest, the largest in Europe, Museum of Illustration opening around the canal near King's Cross somewhere, or maybe further up towards Angel. It used to be in Coldrop's Yard. But then beyond those things, I was going to also mention the amount of things that are to do with art and theatre, especially across London, that relate directly to video games now, is incredible. There was an artist, one particular example, a guy called Lu Yang. Actually, not a guy, it's a they, them.
Yep.
Lu Yang, and they created an arcade where all of the arcade machines were their creation, the cabinets, the games themselves. everything was an artistic statement. Everything was sort of interesting. There's another artist called Sal Fay, who created a whole city in Second Life, which is sort of a bit of a pastiche of a Chinese city.
Yes.
There are people doing photography exhibitions based on the photography in GTA. There was an artist called Corey Archangel that exhibited work that was essentially levels of the first Mario game, with everything taken out apart from the clouds. And it was just called Mario Clouds. They drift by.
Wow.
It's very nice. Theatre as well. There's a theatre company that puts on Shakespeare in Fallout, so you can stumble across them.
Yes, I've heard of them, yeah.
That's like quite a famous example of it. But there's also people who do plays in Grand Theft Auto. You know, you sort of watch it in-game or you live stream it. Absolutely tons of it. There was a play that I saw that had Call of Duty projected into the wall behind as well, quite recently, about men, and that was excellent. So I think that it's getting harder and harder to separate video games from the sort of more classically edifying art forms. But sorry, when I spoke to the theatre critic here and the art critic, Eddie and Andre, they had tons of examples of how these things have come together. Especially in art right now, it seems to be a big thing. People create their own video games to sort of make to create a statement on something else.
Yeah. There was an exhibition at the Turner Gallery recently where the artist had a whole room dedicated to the influence of games on his work. So I think you're dead right. It's good time to be doing that kind of work. Well, Joe, thank you so much for this. It's been great to talk to you and hear your choices in your life and all your experience in magazines. Really incisive and interesting. So thank you.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Ah, wasn't that a lovely time? Thank you so much to my guest, Joe McTish. Absolutely loved that. Loved hearing all of Joe's very, very good anecdotes. But of course, also his fine choices. I've got to say, putting that edit together and when the Shenmue music kicks in, oh my gosh, felt a bit teary at that. That's what a fine game. What a fine time of life that was when the Dreamcast was out. Yu Suzuki's making Shenmue. Yes. Yes. I mean, the game, let's be honest, perhaps doesn't hold up that well. And perhaps even at the time was a little boring, but it was very novel, that's for certain. We were scratching around for the name of the protagonist. It was, of course, Ryo, with an O, Ryo. Ryo Hazuki, and the town that they're poking around in, or that Ryo is living out his student life and doing all the working in the docks and all that, was Yokosuka, the sleeping little Japanese town. What a vibe that game was, and loved hearing Joseph recall all the things that made that game so special, as well as, of course, his other choices as well. Right, so a few points of order I need to go through there. This episode was recorded, as you heard, right before the coronation of the king, which was slightly before, I regret to say, the very sad and untimely death of Martin Amis, who we talked about, one of my favourite writers. No surprise there. A sort of male writer of my age really likes Martin Amis. Stop the press. But hey, his writing has meant a lot to me, especially his non-fiction stuff, which I've found very influential. Got into it through my dear friend Christian Donlan, who has been reading Martin his whole life. So it was sort of lovely to have that anecdote that Joe gave us of watching Mortal Kombat 2, I think, was it, in the arcade, by Queensway Ice Rink or wherever it was, standing there with the great man himself, while Martin's eldest son, Lewis, was off playing with Joe's brother, younger brother. Wasn't expecting that story. And I was sort of tempted to put this episode out around that, but thought I'd give it a little bit of space. And anyway, if you're a fan of Amis, then I'm sure you enjoyed that anecdote as well. Right, it was indeed, of course, Chris Cunningham, the director of the Aphex Twin videos, who did the PlayStation advert that we're talking about. We have talked about that advert before, on a previous episode with Suze Kempner, because her current comedy tour is the poster for that plays. It's a sort of riff on that advert. So yeah, Chris Cunningham, whose work is stands up, I would say, very well today. Joe is also the host of a brand new podcast that's coming out with Time Out. It's called Love Thy Neighbourhood. And in the series, Joe accompanies famous Londoners as they take him around their favourite bits of London. It is a lot of fun. There's only one episode and a trailer out, but it is very cool. You can see Bimini Bomb Boulash from RuPaul's Drag Race, UK edition. Chloe Petz is taking Joe around Streatham. Doc Brown, the brilliant poet, comedian, is drinking Guinness on the Kilburn High Road with Joe. Anyway, get along, get onto Spotify. You can subscribe to that. It's great. It's great fun. So, yeah, sub to that right now. Okay, Joe said that he would like to name his console Grey Box in Russian. My Russian's not very good. I can say a handful of words. I've only been to Moscow once. I am writing a book, actually, at the moment, right at the end of it, about to submit my first draft that is set in Leningrad, or what is now St. Petersburg. So I have been spending a lot of time looking at Russian language stuff. But yeah, rather than murdering that phrase, here is how Google pronounces grey box in Russian.
Серая коробка. Серая коробка.
So there you go. If someone could add that to the My Perfect Console data spreadsheet, that would be much appreciated. On that note, yes, you can. Very lovely My Perfect Console Patreon supporters have put together a giant spreadsheet with all of the guests that have been on the podcast, with the names of their consoles, with their five game choices. It's even got a tab that shows the current rankings for those games, which ones have been chosen the most. It will be no surprise to anyone who's listened to all of the episodes so far that the game in the lead is Disco Elysium. So well on course to be crowned at least the most picked game of 2023. Pop along. I've advertised the link on the My Perfect Console Twitter account, which is at My Perfect Console with the O's removed. Or you can just go to our Patreon page, patreon.com/myperfectconsole. There is a public post there. Maybe I'll pin it, and then you can always find it easily. That, if you click on that, then you can go and browse everyone's choices. There are links to all of the episodes on that page, as well as the broadcast, if that's the right word, the date that the podcast came out, the date it landed. So you can, you can go and pore over that data. It's good fun. Right. Thank you again, Joe. Brilliant. Loved talking to him. And thank you for the very kind words that he said about working with me. I, as he said, have done a couple of pieces with Joe, Full Disclosure, where he was my editor back, I think, when he was working for Shortlist. But I haven't met Joe, and just really got along well with him and loved all his stories. So, yeah, it was great. I'm sure you all enjoyed listening to that too. Right, if you would like to write to me, you can do so at myperfectconsole@gmail.com. If you would like to support the podcast, please go to Patreon, become a Patreon supporter. It really does help just keep everything going, and also you get loads of benefits. You get to be part of the My Perfect Console community, try and do posts regularly. You get to see which guests are coming up each month. You get to ask questions to those guests. They're going to start coming out soon, those little bonus Patreon episodes just with community questions. And later on this year, we're going to be doing the My Perfect Console Knockout to find out the best console of the year. Okay. That's probably everything from me for now. Thank you again for listening this far into the podcast. It's great to have you. If you're new, then go back, listen. We've got some fantastic episodes in our back catalogue and some good ones coming up as well. Leave us a review or a rating, and definitely subscribe. And I will be back again next week. Have a great week, and I'll see you then.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.